Welcome, friend, to Spider on the Web number 53. Since this is my first monthly podcast, I wanted to do something special for you, so I'm going to open with some music composed by God herself. Seriously, have a listen, and I'll explain after. There you go. Clocks in at a little over 3 minutes. Trust God to know how long a hit single ought to be. And that one in particular is a golden oldie, you feel me. Dr. William Campbell has had a successful career in Canada and Japan as a molecular biologist, but he has also had several exhibitions of his graphic art in both those countries. He studied painting at Concordia, McGill, and the Montreal Museum of Fine Art, and holds a diploma in photography from the Dawson Institute. You can check out his remarkable art for yourself at BillCampbellArt.com. Now, Bill and I are both members of a small social group Kettlebelly Baldwin might belong to if he lived in Vancouver. And Bill recently wrote me, "You may be amused to hear what 12 different proteins sound like." My son Matthew and I did some musical arrangements using DNA and corresponding amino acids to generate some interesting MIDI files. They were made using hydropathic properties of amino acids and assigning notes on different scales, i.e. major, minor, pentatonic, etc. Background is DNA, tempo, instruments, etc. vary for each protein. The one you just heard was human epidermal growth factor receptor, tyrosine kinase. Readers of my collaboration with Robert Heinlein, Variable Star, may recall a passage where the narrator explains that infants born so premature they lack a sucking reflex can actually be taught to eat, and thus to survive, by tempting them with music. That the desire to hear music is more deeply hardwired in our DNA than the desire to eat, to live. Well, what you just heard was an important part of one of the very first songs you ever heard way before you had ears, the one that told you to keep getting bigger. If you'd like to hear the other 11 proteins, go to kinexus.ca, K-I-N-E-X-U-S, click on Science and Technology, and scroll way down that menu to Music. Okay, what could be more appropriate to follow the music of God than the lyrics of John Hendricks? One of the most haunting songs I know is Estate, written by two guys named Bruno, and recorded by many great artists. One of my favorite versions is by João Gilberto. I love to play it myself, but the Brunos are Bruno Martino and Bruno Brighetti, and the damn lyrics are in Italian. If you Google around, you can find a couple of English translations, and they're all hopeless. But for some reason, few seem to know the good lyrics by the greatest lyricist in the history of jazz, John Hendricks. I copped them from his Grammy-nominated CD, Freddie Freeloader. John has won 7 Grammys. But I don't have his permission to podcast a track from it, so I thought I'd take a crack at it myself on Lady Macbeth, My Guitar. As in Spider in the Web number 52, I'm too busy for retakes, so if it sounds like I screwed something up in this, you can assume I probably did. But it seems a most appropriate song for an August podcast, because in English, estate is in summer. Summer, I love you more than any other season. My heart has lost all thought of rhyme or reason. Without you, it's like winter in my heart. In summer, memory of the things we together are stronger than the trials we had to weather. I can't believe that you and I could part. It's the end of life's dead dream, like plucking all the petals from the roses, like burying all the secrets love discloses, like stopping songs of birds before they start. In summer, when once again I feel your desire, as you return to set my soul on fire. Without you, it's like winter in my heart. In summer, once again I feel the old desire, as you return to set my soul on fire. Without you, it's like winter in my All right. After that mournful song, I have some happy, nay, joyous news. I've spoken before of my disappointment at the tiny number of available science fiction audio stories as opposed to audio books. Well, I've decided to get on my ass and do something about it. I'm happy to report that some of my favorite science fiction writers of all time have graciously given me permission to read some of my favorite stories of theirs in this podcast. And I'm overjoyed to report that the first one is going to be something very much like God writing the lyrics instead of the melody this time. Be talking about my mainest man, Frederick Pohl, and what may very well be the ultimate science fiction short story, Day Million. Day Million by Frederick Pohl. Copyright 1966 by Rogue Magazine. On this day I want to tell you about, which will be about 1,000 years from now, there were a boy, a girl, and a love story. Now, although I haven't said much so far, none of it is true. The boy was not what you and I would normally think of as a boy, because he was 187 years old. Nor was the girl a girl, for other reasons, and the love story did not entail that sublimation of the urge to rape and concurrent postponement of the instinct to submit, which we at present understand in such matters. You won't care much for this story if you don't grasp these facts at once. If, however, you will make the effort, you'll likely enough find it jam-packed, chock-full, and tip-top crammed with laughter, tears, and poignant sentiment which may or may not be worthwhile. The reason the girl was not a girl was that she was a boy. How angrily you recoil from the page! You say, who the hell wants to read about a pair of queers? Calm yourself. Here are no hot-breathing secrets of perversion for the coterie trade. In fact, if you were to see this girl, you would not guess that she was in any sense a boy. Breasts, 2. Vagina, 1. Hips, callipygian. Face, hairless. Superorbital lobes, non-existent. You would term her female at once, although it is true that you might wonder just what species she was a female of, being confused by the tail, the silky pelt, or the gill slits behind each ear. Now you recoil again. Cripes, man, take my word for it. This is a sweet kid, and if you, as a normal male, spent as much as an hour in a room with her, you would bend heaven and earth to get her in the sack. Dora, we will call her that, her name was Omicron Dibase 7 Group Totter Oot Estoratus 5314, the last part of which is a color specification corresponding to a shade of green. Dora, I say, was feminine, charming, and cute. I admit she doesn't sound that way. She was, as you might put it, a dancer. Her art involved qualities of intellection and expertise of a very high order, requiring both tremendous natural capacities and endless practice. It was performed in null gravity, and I can best describe it by saying that it was something like the performance of a contortionist and something like classical ballet, maybe resembling Danilova's Dying Swan. It was also pretty damn sexy. In a symbolic way, to be sure, but face it, most of the things we call sexy are symbolic, you know, except perhaps an exhibitionist's open fly. On Day Million, when Dora danced, the people who saw her panted, and you would too. About this business of her being a boy, it didn't matter to her audiences that genetically she was male. It wouldn't matter to you if you were among them, because you wouldn't know it. Not unless you took a biopsy cutting of her flesh and put it under an electron microscope to find the XY chromosome. And it didn't matter to them, because they didn't care. Through techniques which are not only complex, but haven't yet been discovered, these people were able to determine a great deal about the aptitudes and easements of babies quite a long time before they were born. At about the second horizon of cell division, to be exact, when the segmenting egg is becoming a free blastocyst, and then they naturally help those attitudes along. Wouldn't we? If we find a child with an aptitude for music, we give him a scholarship to Juilliard. If they found a child whose aptitudes were for being a woman, they made him one. As sex has long been disassociated from reproduction, this was relatively easy to do and caused no trouble and no, or at least very little, comment. How much is very little? Oh, about as much as would be caused by our own tampering with divine will by filling a tooth. Less than would be caused by wearing a hearing aid. Does it still sound awful? then look closely at the next busty babe you meet and reflect that she may be a Dora. For adults who are genetically male but somatically female are far from unknown even in our own time. An accident of environment in the womb overwhelms the blueprints of heredity. The difference is that with us it happens only by accident, and we don't know about it except rarely after close study, whereas the people of Day Million did it often, on purpose, because they wanted to. Well, that's enough to tell you about Dora. It would only confuse you to add that she was 7 feet tall and smelled of peanut butter. Let us begin our story. On Day Million, Dora swam out of her house, entered a transportation tube, was sucked briskly to the surface in its flow of water, and ejected in its plume of spray to an elastic platform in front of her, call it her rehearsal hall. "Oh, shit!" she cried in pretty confusion, reaching out to catch her balance and find herself tumble against a total stranger, whom we will call Don. They met cute. Don was on his way to have his legs renewed. Love was the farthest thing from his mind, but when, absent-mindedly taking a shortcut across the landing platform for Submarinites and finding himself drenched, he discovered his arms full of the loveliest girl he had ever seen, he knew at once that they were meant for each other.
"Will you marry me?" he asked.
She said softly, "Wednesday." And the promise was like a caress. Don was tall, muscular, bronze, and exciting. His name was no more Don than Dora's was Dora, but the personal part of it was Adonis in tribute to his vibrant maleness, and so we will call him Don for short. His personality color code in angstrom units was 5290, or only a few degrees bluer than Dora's 5314, a measure of what they had intuitively discovered at first sight, that they possessed many affinities of taste and interest. I despair of telling you exactly what it was that Don did for a living. I don't mean for the sake of making money. I mean for the sake of giving purpose and meaning to his life, to keep him from going off his nut with boredom, except to say that it involved a lot of traveling. He traveled in interstellar spaceships. In order to make a spaceship go really fast, about 31 male and 7 genetically female human beings had to do certain things, and Don was one of the 31. Actually, he contemplated options. This involved a lot of exposure to radiation flux, not so much from his own station in the propulsive system as in the spillover from the next stage, where a genetic female preferred selections, and the subnuclear particles making the selections she preferred demolished themselves in a shower of quanta. Well, you don't give a rat's ass for that, but it meant that Don had to be clad at all times in a skin of light, resilient, extremely strong copper-colored metal. I have already mentioned this, but you probably thought I meant he was sunburned. More than that, he was a cybernetic man. Most of his ruder parts had long since been replaced with mechanisms of vastly more permanence and use. A cadmium centrifuge, not a heart, pumped his blood. His lungs moved only when he wanted to speak out loud, for a cascade of osmotic filters rebreathed oxygen out of his own wastes. In a way, he probably would have looked peculiar to a man from the 20th century, with his glowing eyes and seven-fingered hands, but to himself, and of course to Dora, he looked mighty manly and grand. In the course of his voyages, Don had circled Proxima Centauri, Procyon, and the puzzling worlds of Miracete. He had carried agricultural templates to the planets of Canopus and brought back warm, witty pets from the pale companion of Aldebaran. Blue hot or red cool, he had seen 1,000 stars and their 10,000 planets. He had in fact been traveling the star lanes with only brief leaves on Earth for pushing 2 centuries. But you don't care about that either. It is people that make stories, not the circumstances they find themselves in, and you want to hear about these two people. Well, they made it. The great thing they had for each other grew and flowered and burst into fruition on Wednesday, just as Dora had promised. They met at the encoding room with a couple of well-wishing friends apiece to cheer them on, and while their identities were being taped and stored, they smiled and whispered to each other and bore the jokes of their friends with blushing repartee. Then they exchanged their mathematical analogues and went away, Dora to her dwelling beneath the surface of the sea and Don to his ship. It was an idyll, really. They lived happily ever after, or anyway until they decided not to bother anymore and died. Of course, they never set eyes on each other again. Oh, I can see you now, you eaters of charcoal-broiled steak, scratching an incipient bunion with one hand and holding this story with the other while the stereo plays Dandy or Monk. You don't believe a word of it, do you? Not for 1 minute. People wouldn't live like that, you say with an irritated and not amused grunt as you get up to put fresh ice in a stale drink. And yet there's Dora hurrying back through the Flushing commuter pipes toward her underwater home. She prefers it there, has had herself somatically altered to breathe the stuff. If I tell you with what sweet fulfillment she fits the recorded analog of Don into the symbol manipulator, hooks herself in and turns herself on, if I try to tell you any of that, you will simply stare, or glare, and grumble, "What the hell kind of lovemaking is this?" And yet, I assure you, friend, I really do assure you that Dora's ecstasies are as creamy and passionate as any of James Bond's lady spies, and one hell of a lot more so than anything you are going to find in real life. Go ahead, glare and grumble. Dora doesn't care. If she thinks of you at all, her 30 times great-great-grandfather, she thinks you're a pretty primordial sort of brute. You are. Why, Dora is farther removed from you than you are from the Australopithecines of 5,000 centuries ago. You could not swim a second in the strong currents of her life. You don't think progress goes in a straight line, do you? Do you recognize that it is an ascending, accelerating, maybe even exponential curve? It takes hell's own time to get started, but when it goes like a bomb. And you... You scotch-drinking steak-eater in your relaxicizer chair, you've just barely lighted the prime accord of the fuse. What is it now, 600,000 or 700,000th day after Christ? Dora lives in day million, 1,000 years from now. Her body fats are polyunsaturated like Crisco. Her wastes are hemodialyzed out of her bloodstream while she sleeps. That means she doesn't have to go to the bathroom. On whim, to pass a slow half-hour, she can command more energy than the entire nation of Portugal can spend today and use it to launch a weekend satellite or remold a crater on the moon. She loves Don very much. She keeps his every gesture, mannerism, nuance, touch of hand, thrill of intercourse, passion of kiss, stored in symbolic mathematical form. And when she wants him, all she has to do is turn the machine on, and she has him. Then Don, of course, has Dora. Adrift on a sponson city a few hundred yards over her head, or orbiting Arcturus 50 light-years away, Don has only to command his own symbol manipulator to rescue Dora from the ferrite files and bring her to life for him, and there she is, and rapturously, tirelessly, they bawl all night. Not in the flesh, of course, but then his flesh has been extensively altered, and it wouldn't really be much fun. He doesn't need the flesh for pleasure. Genital organs feel nothing. Neither do hands, nor breasts, nor lips. They are only receptors, accepting and transmitting impulses. It is the brain that feels. It is the interpretation of those impulses that makes agony or orgasm. And Don's symbol manipulator gives him the analog of cuddling, the analog of kissing, the analog of wildest, most ardent hours with the eternal, exquisite, and incorruptible analog of Dora. For Diane, or Sweet Rose, or Laughing Alicia, for to be sure, they have each of them exchanged analogs before, and will again. Balls, you say, it looks crazy to me. And you, with your aftershave lotion and your little red car, pushing papers across a desk all day and chasing tail all night. Tell me, just how the hell do you think you would look to Tiglath-Pileser, say, or Attila the Hun? Well, damn, that's what I'm talking about. Seems to me that Comrade Paul nailed the basic message of science fiction in a single short story. Said message being, the future is going to be stranger than we can possibly imagine. Hey, let's take a crack at it. All right. Continuing at that level of excellence, last podcast, Spider on the Web number 52, I played you music by a whole bunch of the headliners at this summer's Vancouver Island Music Fest. Some I didn't get around to. I had managed to locate a single torrent that contained three of them. Unfortunately, the torrent took a long time to download, so it just came in. But I think you'll end up agreeing it was worth waiting for. The first voice you're going to hear is that of Mr. Bella Fleck. Then you'll be hearing the sounds of Earl Scruggs on the banjo, Jerry Douglas on the dobro, the great Vassar Clemens on fiddle, Brian Sutton on guitar, Sam Bush on mandolin, and Mark Schatz on the bass. I'll cop, bluegrass is not my favorite kind of music, but when it's at this level of expertise, these guys are players of the same level of excellence as anybody in jazz or anybody in classical music. Just sit back and give yourself a treat. This is Bella, Earl, Jerry, and the boys blowing a tune called Ground Speed.
I want to say what an honor and a pleasure it is for me to be on stage with all these incredible musicians, and that they all did this record with me. And we're all good old friends for at least 20-something years, except Brian, of course, who hasn't been born that long.
Thank you.
All right. Now let us sustain that level of excellence with yet another story by the great Fred Pohl. This one happens to not only be a favorite of mine, it's being made into a movie as we speak. It's called We Purchased People, and I'm going to preface it with the introduction that Fred gives to it in his story collection, Pohl Stars. Jack Williamson and I have collaborated on 8 or 9 novels over the years. I've collaborated with a number of other writers, and so I know what I'm talking about when I proclaim that working with Jack, who is a wise and gentle human being, is as nearly painless as writing ever gets, especially collaborative writing. Still, there are times when our interests diverge a little. As in all writing, there are occasions when one of us thinks up a scene or a situation that is too attractive to throw away but doesn't fit properly into the joint effort. When Jack and I were writing our novel, Farthest Star, we each came up with one of those displaced bits. Jack's was a lovely sequence that dealt with an immense mountain called Knife in the Sky. The episode he had in mind did not fit into the novel, but he made it into a short story for Boy's life. Mine was this one, We Purchased People. There are some themes that I seem to come back to over and over. The only way I realize that is by thinking the process over afterward with its history. I'm not usually conscious of it while I'm doing it. One of those themes is overpopulation, a theme on which you will observe I have played variations at least twice in this collection alone. Another is the idea of possession. That appears not only in the two novels with Jack Williamson, Farthest Star and its sequel, Wall Around a Star, but in my solo novel, Plague of Pythons, lately revised and re-released as The Demon in the Skull, and several short stories, including this one. Why is this theme so permanently appealing to me over decades? I have a suspicion that there is a psychological basis for it. I wonder if it does not represent a metaphor for a deep-seated fear of manipulation from outside, of control by external forces that overrule our basic instinctual decency and common sense. But I guess I will leave the resolution of that question to my shrink. We Purchased People by Frederick Pohl. Copyright 1984 by Frederick Pohl. On the 3rd of March, the purchased person named Wayne Golden took part in trade talks in Washington as the representative of the dominant race of the Groombridge Star. What he had to offer was the license of the basic patents on a device to convert nuclear power plant waste products into fuel cells. It was a good item, with a ready market. Since half of Idaho was already bubbling with radioactive wastes, the Americans were anxious to buy, and he sold it for a credit of $100 million. On the following day, he flew to Spain. He was allowed to sleep all the way, stretched out across 2 seats in the first-class section of the Concorde, with the fastenings of a safety belt gouging into his side. On the 5th of the month, he used up part of the trade credit in the purchase of 15 Picasso oils on canvas, the videotape of a flamenco performance, and a 15th-century harpsichord gilt with carved legs. He arranged for them to be preserved, crated, and shipped in bond to Orlando, Florida, after which the items would be launched from Cape Kennedy on a voyage through space that would take more than 12,000 years. The Groombridgians were not in a hurry and thought big. The Saturn V booster rocket cost $11 million in itself. It did not matter. There was plenty of money left in the Groombridge credit balance. On the 5th of the month, Golden returned to the United States, made a close connection at Logan Airport in Boston, and arrived early at his home kennel in Chicago. He was then given 85 minutes of freedom. I knew exactly what to do with my 85 minutes. I always know. See, when you're working for the people who own you, you don't have any choice about what you do, but up to a point you can think pretty much whatever you like. The thing you get in your head only controls you. It doesn't change you. Anyway, I don't think it does. Would I know if I were changed? My owners never lie to me. Never. I don't think they know what a lie is. If I ever needed anything to prove that they weren't human, that would be plenty, even if I didn't know they lived 86 zillion miles away near some star that I can't even see. They don't tell me much, but they don't lie. Not ever lying, that makes you wonder what they're like. I don't mean physically. I looked that up in the library once when I had a couple of hours of free time. I don't remember where, maybe in Paris at the Bibliothèque Nationale. Anyway, I couldn't read what the language in the book said. But I saw the photographs on the holograms. I remember the physical appearance of my owners, all right. Jesus. The Altarians look kind of like spiders, and the Syrians are a little bit like crabs. But those folks from the Groombridge Star, boy, they're something else. I felt bad about it for a long time, knowing I'd been sold to something that looked as much like a cluster of maggots on an open wound as anything else I'd ever seen. On the other hand, they're all those miles away, and all I ever have to do with them is receive their fast radio commands and do what they tell me. No touching or anything. So what does it matter what they look like? But what kind of freaky creature is it that never says anything that is not objectively the truth, never changes its mind, never makes a promise that it doesn't keep? They aren't machines, I know, but maybe they think I'm kind of a machine. You wouldn't bother to lie to a machine, would you? You wouldn't make it any promises. You wouldn't do it any favors either, and they never do me any. They don't tell me that I can have 85 minutes off because I've done something they like, or because they want to sweeten me up because they want something from me. Everything considered, that's silly. What could they want? It isn't as if I had any choice. Ever. So they don't lie or threaten or bribe or reward. But for some reason, they sometimes give me minutes or hours or days off, and this time I had 85 minutes. I started using it right away, the way I always do. The first thing was to check at the kennel location desk to see where Carolyn was. The locator clerk, he isn't owned. He works for a salary and treats us like shit. Knows me by now. "Ah, hell, Wayne boy," he said with that imitation sympathy and lying friendliness that makes me want to kill him. "You just missed the lady friend. Saw her, let's see, Wednesday, was it? But she's gone." "Where to?" I asked him. He pushed around the cards on the locator board for a while. He knows I don't have very much time ever, so he uses it up for me and said, "Nope, not on my board at all. Say, I wonder, was she with that bunch that went to Peking? Or was that the other little fat broad with the big boobs?" I didn't stop to kill him. If she wasn't on the board, she wasn't in 85-minute transportation range, so my 85 minutes, 79 minutes, wasn't going to get me near her. I went to the men's room, jerked off quickly, and went out into the miserable, biting March Chicago wind to use up my 79 minutes. 71 minutes. There's a nice Mexican kind of restaurant near the kennel a couple blocks away past Ohio. They know me there. They don't care who I am. Maybe the brass plate in my head doesn't bother them because they think it's great that people from the other stars are doing such nice things for the world, or maybe it's because I tip big. What else do I have to do with the money I get? I stuck my head in, whistled at Terry the bartender, and said, "The usual, I'll be back in 10 minutes. Then I walked up to Michigan and bought a clean shirt and changed into it, leaving the smelly old one. 66 minutes. In the drugstore on the corner, I picked up a couple of porno paperbacks and stuck them in my pockets, bought some cigarettes, leaned over and kissed the hand of the cashier, who was slim and fair-complexioned and smelled good, left her startled behind me, and got back to the restaurant just as Alicia, the waitress, was putting the gazpacho and the 2 bottles of beer on my table. 59 minutes. I settled down to enjoy my time. I smoked and I ate and I drank the beer, smoking between bites, drinking between puffs. You really look forward to something like that when you're working and not your own boss. I don't mean they don't let us eat when we're working. Of course they do, but we don't have any choice about what we eat or where we eat it. Pump fuel into the machine, keep it running. So I finished the guacamole and sent Alicia back for more of it when she brought the chocolate cake and American coffee and ate the cake and the guacamole in alternate forkfuls. 18 minutes. If I had had a little more time, I would have jerked off again, but I didn't, so I paid the bill, tipped everybody, and left the restaurant. I got to the block where the kennel was with maybe 2 minutes to spare. Along the curb, a slim woman in a fur jacket and pantsuit was walking her Scotty away from me. I went up behind her and said, "I'll give you $50 for a kiss." She turned around. She was all of 60 years old, but not bad, really, so I kissed her and gave her the $50. 0 minutes, and I had just made it into the kennel when I felt a tingling in my forehead, and my owners took over again. In the next 7 days of March, Wayne Golden visited Karachi, Srinagar, and Butte, Montana, on the business of the Groombridgians. He completed 32 assigned tasks. Quite unexpectedly, he was then given 1,000 minutes of freedom. That time I was in, I think it was Pocatello, Idaho, or someplace like that. I had to send a TWX to the faggy locator clerk in Chicago to ask about Carolyn. He took his time answering, as I knew he would. I walked around a little bit, waiting to hear. Everybody was very cheerful, smiling as they walked around through the dusty, sprinkly snow that was coming down, even smiling at me as though they didn't care that I was purchased, as they could plainly see from the golden oval of metal across my forehead that my owners used to tell me what to do. Then the message came back from Chicago. "Sorry, Wayne, baby, but Carolyn isn't on my board. If you find her, give her one for me." Well, all right. I have plenty of spending money, so I checked into a hotel. The bellboy brought me a fifth of scotch and plenty of ice fast because he knew why I was in a hurry and that I would tip for speed. When I asked about hookers, he offered anything I liked. I told him white, slim, beautiful asses. That's what I first noticed about Carolyn. It's special for me. The little girl I did in New Brunswick, what was her name? Rachel? She was only 9 years old, but she had an ass on her you wouldn't believe. I showered and put on clean clothes. The owners don't really give you enough time for that sort of thing. A lot of the time I smell. A lot of times I've almost wet my pants because they didn't let me go when I needed to. Once or twice I just couldn't help myself, held out as long as I could, and boy, you feel lousy when that happens. The worst was when I was covering some kind of symposium in Russia, a place with a name like Akademgorodok. It was supposed to be on nuclear explosion processes. I don't know anything about that kind of stuff, and anyway, I was a little mixed up because I thought that was one of the things the Star People had done for us, worked out some way the different countries didn't have to have nuclear weapons and bombs and wars and so on anymore. But that wasn't what they meant. It was explosions at the nucleus of the galaxy they meant. Astronomical stuff. Just when a fellow named Isaac was talking about how the FG prominence and the EMK prominence, whatever they were really part of an expanding pulse sphere, whatever that is, I crapped my pants. I knew I was going to. I'd tried to tell the Groombridge people about it. They wouldn't listen. Then the session redactor came down the aisle and shouted in my ear, as though my owners were deaf or stupid, that they would have to get me out of there, please, for reasons concerning the comfort and hygiene of the other participants. I thought they would be angry because that meant they were going to miss some of this conference that they were interested in. They didn't do anything to me, though. I mean, as if there was anything they could do to me that would be any worse or any different from what they do to me all the time, and always will. When I was all clean and in an open-necked shirt and chinos, I turned on the TV and poured a mild drink. I didn't want to be still drunk when my 1,000 minutes were up. There was a special program on all the networks, something celebrating a treaty between the United Nations and a couple of the Star People, the Syrians and Capellans, it seemed to be. Everybody was very happy about it, because it seemed that now the Earth had bought some agricultural and chemical information, and pretty soon there would be more food than we could eat. How much we owed to the Star People, the Secretary General of the UN was saying in Brazilian accented English. We could look forward to their wise guidance to help Earth survive its multitudinous crises and problems, and we should all be very happy. But I wasn't happy, not even with a glass of John Begg and the hooker on her way up, because what I really wanted was Carolyn. Carolyn was a purchased person, like me. I had seen her a couple of dozen times, all in all. Not usually when either of us was on freedom. Almost never when both of us were. It was sort of like falling in love by postcard, except that now and then we were physically close, even touching, and once or twice we had been briefly not only together but out from under control. We had had about 8 minutes once in Bucharest after coming back from the big hydropower plant at the Iron Gate. That was the record so far. Outside of that, it was just that we passed, able to see each other but not to do anything about it, in the course of our duties, or that one of us was free and found the other. When that happened, the one of us that was free could talk and even touch the other one in any way that didn't interfere with what the other was doing. The one that was working couldn't do anything active, but could hear or feel. We were both totally careful to avoid interfering with actual work. I don't know what would have happened if we had interfered. Maybe nothing. We didn't want to take that chance, though sometimes it was a temptation I could almost not resist. There was a time when I was free and I found Carolyn working but not doing anything active, just standing there at TWA Gate 51 at the St. Louis Airport. She was waiting for someone to arrive. I really wanted to kiss her. I talked to her. I patted her, you know, holding my trench coat over my arm so that people passing by wouldn't notice anything, or at least wouldn't notice anything much. I told her things I wanted her to hear. But what I wanted was to kiss her, and I was afraid to. Kissing her on the mouth would have meant putting my head in front of her eyes. I didn't think I wanted to chance that. It might have meant she wouldn't see the person she was there to see, who turned out to be a Ghanaian police officer arriving to discuss the sale of some political prisoners to the Groombridgians. I was there when he came down the ramp, but I couldn't stay to see if she would by any chance be free after completing the negotiations with him, because then my own time ran out. But I had had 3 hours that time being right near her. It felt very sad and very strange, and I wouldn't have given it up for anything in the world. I knew she could hear and feel everything, even if she couldn't respond. Even when the owners are running you, there's a little personal part of you that stays alive. I talked to that part of her. I told her how much I wished we could kiss and go to bed and be with each other. Oh, hell. I even told her I loved her and wanted to marry her, though we both know perfectly well that's not ever going to be any chance of that ever. We don't get pensioned off or retired. We're owned. Anyway, I stayed with her as long as I could there. I paid for it later. Balls, it felt as though I'd been stomped, the insides of my undershorts wet and chilly. And there wasn't any way in the world for me to do anything about it, not even by masturbating, until my next free time. That turned out to be 3 weeks later. In Switzerland, for God's sake. Out of season. With nobody in the hotel except the waiters and bellboys and a couple of old ladies who looked at the gold oval in my forehead as though it smelled bad. It is a terrible but cherished thing to love without hope. I pretended there was hope, always. Every bit of freedom I got, I tried to find her. They keep pretty careful tabs on us, all 200,000 or 300,000 of us purchased persons working for whichever crazy bunch of creepy crawlers or gassy ghosts happens to have bought us to be their remote access facilities on the planet they themselves cannot ever visit. Carolyn and I were owned by the same bunch, which had its good side and its bad side. The good side was that there was a chance that someday we would be free for quite a long while at the same time. It happened. I don't know why. Shifts change on the Groombridge planet, or they have a holiday or something. But every once in a while there would be a whole day, maybe a week, when none of the Groombridge people would be doing anything at all, and all of us would be free at once. The bad side was that they hardly ever needed to have more than one of us in one place, so Carolyn and I didn't run into each other a lot. And the times when I was free for a pretty good period, it took most of that to find her, and by the time I did, she was like half a world away. No way of getting there and back in time for duty. I did so much want to fuck her, but we had never made it that far, and maybe never would. I never even got a chance to ask her what she had been sentenced for in the first place. I really didn't know her at all, except enough to love her. When the bellboy turned up with my girl, I was comfortably buzzed with my feet up and the Rangers on the TV. She didn't look like a hooker particularly. She was wearing hip huggers cut below the navel, bigger breasted than I cared about, but with that beautiful curve of waist and back into hips that I like. Her name was Nikki. The bellboy took my money, took 5 for himself, passed the rest to her, and disappeared, grinning. What's so funny about it? He knew what I was because the plate in my head told him, but he had to think it was funny. Do you want me to take my clothes off? She had a pretty, breathless little voice, long red hair, and a sweet, broad, friendly face.
Go ahead,
I said. She slipped off the sandals. Her feet were clean, a little ridged where the straps went. Stepped out of the hip-huggers and folded them across the back of Conrad Hilton's standard armchair, took off the blouse and folded it, ducked out of the medallion and draped it over the blouse, down to red lace bra and red bikini panties. Then she turned back the bedclothes, got in, sat up, snapped off the bra, snuggled down, kicked the panties out the side of the bed, and pulled the covers over her.
"Any time, honey," she said.
But I didn't lay her. I didn't even get into bed with her, not under the covers. I drank some more of the scotch, and that and fatigue put me out, and when I woke up it was daylight, and she had cleaned out my wallet. 71 minutes left. I paid the bill with a check and persuaded them to give me car fare and change. Then I headed back for the kennel. All I got out of it was clean clothes and a hangover. I think I had scared her a little. Everybody knows how we purchased people came to be up for sale, and maybe they're not all the way sure that we won't do something bad again, because they don't know how reliably our owners keep us from ever doing anything they don't like. But I wished she hadn't stolen my money. The overall strategies and objectives of the Star people, particularly the people from the Groombridge Star who were his own masters, were unclear to the purchased person named Wayne Golden. What they did was not hard to understand. All the world knew that the Star people had established fast radio contact with the people of Earth, and that in order to conduct their business on Earth, they had purchased the bodies of certain convicted criminals, installing in them tachyon fast radio transceivers. Why they did what they did was less easy to comprehend. Art objects they admired and purchased. Certain rare kinds of plants and flowers they purchased and had frozen at liquid helium temperatures. Certain kinds of utilitarian objects they purchased. Every few months another rocket roared up from Merritt Island just north of the Cape, and another cargo headed for the Groombridge Star on its 12,000-year voyage. Others, to other stars peopled by other races in the galactic confraternity, took shorter times, or longer, but none of the times was short enough for those star people who made the purchases to come to Earth to see what they had bought. The distances were too huge. What they spent most of their money on was the rockets, and of course the people they purchased, into whom they had transplanted their tachyon transceivers. Each rocket cost at least $10 million.
The going rate for a healthy male paranoid capable of 3 or more decades of useful work was in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, and they bought them by the dozen. The other things they bought, all of them, the tape symphonies and early dynasty Ushabti, the flowering orchids and the Van Goghs, cost only a fraction of 1% of what they spent on people and transportation. Of course, they had plenty of money to spend. Each star race sold off licensing rights on its own kinds of technology. All of them received trade credits from every government on Earth for their services in resolving disputes and preventing wars. Still, it seemed to Wayne Golden, to the extent that he was capable of judging the way his masters conducted their affairs, a pretty high overhead way to run a business, though of course neither he nor any other purchased person was ever consulted on questions like that. By late spring he had been on the move for many weeks without rest. He completed 68 tasks, great and small. There was nothing in this period of 87 days that was in any way remarkable, except that on one day in May, while he was observing the riots on the Place de la Concorde from a window of the American Embassy on behalf of his masters, a girl named Carolyn came into his room. She whispered in his ear, attempted unsuccessfully to masturbate him while the liaison attaché was out of the room, remained in all for some 40 minutes, and then left, sobbing softly. He could not even turn his head to see her go. Then on the 6th of June, the purchased person named Wayne Golden was returned to the Dallas kennel and given indefinite furlough, subject to recall at 50 minutes' notice.
Sweetest dear Jesus, nothing like that had ever happened to me before. It was like the warden coming into death row with a last-minute reprieve. I could hardly believe it. But I took it, started moving at once. I got a fix on Carolyn's last reported whereabouts from the locator board and floated away from Dallas in a cloud of Panama red, drinking champagne as fast as the hostesses could bring it to me en route to Colorado. But I didn't find Carolyn there. I hunted her through the streets of Denver, and she was gone. By phone, I learned she had been sent to Rantoul, Illinois. I was off. I checked at the Kansas City airport, where I was changing planes, and she was gone from Illinois already. Probably, but they weren't sure, they thought to the New York district. I put down the phone and jumped on a plane, rented a car at Newark, and drove down the turnpike to the Garden State, checking every car I passed to see if it was the red Volvo they thought she might be driving, stopping at every other Howard Johnson's to ask if they'd seen the girl with short black hair, brown eyes, and a tip-tilted nose, and, oh yes, the golden oval in her forehead. I remember it was in New Jersey that I first got into trouble. There was the 19-year-old movie cashier in Paramus. She was my first. I picked her up after the 1 a.m. show, and I showed her. But she was really all wrong for me, much too old, and I much too worldly. I didn't like it much when she died. After that, I was scared for a while, and I watched the TV news every night, twice, at 6 and 11, and never passed a newsstand without looking at all the headlines in the papers until a couple of months had passed. Then I thought over what I really wanted very carefully. The girl had to be quite young and, well, you can't tell, but as much as I could be sure, a virgin. I sat in a luncheonette in Perth Amboy for 3 whole days watching the kids get out of the parochial school before I found the second. It took a while. The first one that looked good turned out to be a bus kid. The second was a walker, but her big sister from the high school walked with her. The third walked home alone. It was December, and the afternoons got pretty dark, and that Friday she walked, but she didn't get home. I never molested any of them sexually, you know. I mean, in some ways, I'm still kind of a virgin. That wasn't what I wanted. I just wanted to see them die. When they asked me at the pretrial hearing if I knew the difference between right and wrong, I didn't know how to answer them. I knew what I did was wrong for them. But it wasn't wrong for me. It was what I wanted. So driving down the parkway, feeling discouraged about Caroline, I noticed where I was and cut over to Route 35 and doubled back. I drove right to the school, past it, and to the lumber yard where I did the little girl. I stopped and cut the motor, looking around. Happy day. Now it was a different time of year, and things looked a little different. They'd piled up a stack of 2x12s over the place where I'd done her. But in my mind's eye, I could see it the way it had been then. Dark gray sky. Lights from the cars going past. I could hear the little buzzing feeling in her throat as she tried to scream under my fingers. Let's see, that was, oh good heavens, 9 years ago. And if I hadn't done her, she would have been 20 or so, screwing all the boys, probably on dope, maybe knocked up or married. Looked at in a certain way, I saved her a lot of sordid, miserable stuff, menstruating, letting the boys' hands and mouths on her, all that. My head began hurting.
That's one thing the plate in your head does. It doesn't let you get very deeply into the things you did in the old days because it hurts too much. So I started up the car and drove away, and pretty soon the hurting stopped. I never think of Carolyn, you know, that way. They never proved that little girl on me. The one they caught me for was the nurse in Long Branch in the parking lot, and she was a mistake. She was so small, and she had a sweater over her uniform. I didn't know she was grown up until it was too late. I was very angry about that. In a way, I didn't mind when they caught me, because I had been getting very careless. But I really hated that ward in Marlborough where they put me. 7 years, up in the morning and drink your pink medicine out of the little paper cup, make your bed and do your job. Mine was sweeping in the incontinent wards, and the smells and the sights would make you throw up. After a while, they let me watch TV and even read the papers, and when the Altair people made the first contact with Earth, I was interested, and when they began buying criminally insane to be their proxies, I wanted them to buy me. Anything. I wanted anything that would let me get out of that place, even if it meant I'd have to let them put a box in my head and never be able to live a normal life again. But the Altair people wouldn't buy me. For some reason, they only took blacks. Then the others began showing up on the fast radio, making their deals, and still none of them wanted me. The ones from Procyon, like young women, wouldn't ever buy a male. I think they have only one sex there, someone said. All these funnies are peculiar in some way or another. Metal or gas or blobby or hard-shelled and ratly, whatever. And they all have funny habits, like if you belong to the Canopus bunch, you don't ever eat fish. I think they're disgusting, and I don't really know why the USA wanted to get involved with them in the first place. But the Chinese did, and the Russians did, and I guess we just couldn't stay out. I suppose it hasn't hurt much. There hasn't been a war, and there's a lot of ways in which they've helped clean things up for us. It hasn't hurt me, that's for sure. The Groombridge people came into the market pretty late, and most of the good, healthy criminals were gone. They would buy anybody. They bought me. We're a hard-case lot, we Groombridgians, and I do wonder what Carolyn was in for. I drove all the way down the coast, Asbury Park, Brielle, Atlantic City, all the way to Cape May, phoning back to check with the locator clerk, and never found her. The one thing I did know was that all I was missing was the shell of her, because she was working. I could have had a kiss or a feel, no more. But I wanted to find her anyway, just on the chance. How many times do you get an indefinite furlough? If I'd been able to find her and stay with her, sooner or later, maybe she would have been off too, even if it were only for 2 hours, even 30 minutes. And then in broad daylight, just as I was checking into a motel near an army base, with the soldiers' girls lined up at the cashier's window so their boyfriends could get back for reveille, I got the call. Report to the Philadelphia Kennel. Soonest. By then I was giddy for sleep, but I drove that Hertz lump like a Maserati because soonest means soonest. I dumped the car and signed in at the kennel, feeling my heart pounding and my mouth ragged from fatigue and aching because I had blown what would have to be my best chance of really being with Carolyn. "What do they want?" I asked the locator clerk. "Go inside," he said, looking evilly amused. All locator clerks treat us the same, all over the world.
"She'll tell you."
Not knowing who she was, I opened the door and walked through, and there was Carolyn.
"Hello, Wayne," she said. "Hello, Carolyn," I said. I really did not have any idea of what to do at all. She didn't give me a cue. She just sat. It was at that point that it occurred to me to wonder at the fact that she wasn't wearing much, just a shorty nightgown with nothing under it. She was also sitting on a turned-down bed. Now, you would think that considering everything, especially the nature of most of my thinking about Carolyn, that I would have instantly accepted this as a personal gift from God to me of every boy's all-American dream. I didn't. It wasn't the fatigue, either. It was Carolyn. It was the expression on her face, which was neither inviting nor loving, was not even the judgment-reserving look of a girl at a singles bar. What it especially was not was happy. "The thing is, Wayne," she said, "we're supposed to go to bed now, so take off your clothes, why don't you?"
Sometimes I can stand outside of myself and look at me, and even when it's something terrible or something sad, I can see it as funny. It was like that when I did the little girl in Edison Township because her mother had sewed her into her school clothes. I was actually laughing when I said, "Carolyn, what's the matter?"
Well, she said, they want us to ball, Wayne. You know, the Groombridge people, they've got interested in what human beings do to each other, and they want to kind of watch.
I started to ask why us, but I didn't have to. I could see where Carolyn and I had had a lot of that on our minds, and maybe our masters could get curious about it. I didn't exactly like it. Not exactly. In fact, in a way, I kind of hated it. But it was so much better than nothing at all that I said, "Why, honey, that's great," almost meaning it, trying to talk her into it, moving in next to her and putting my arm around her. And then she said, "Only we have to wait, Wayne. They want to do it, not us."
"What do you mean, wait? Wait for what?"
She shrugged under my arm.
"You mean," I said, "that we have to be plugged into them? Like they'll be doing it with our bodies?"
She leaned against me.
"That's what they told me, Wayne. Any minute now, I guess."
I pushed her away.
"Honey," I said, half crying, "all this time I've been wanting to... Jesus, Carolyn! I mean, it isn't just that I wanted to go to bed with you. I mean, I'm sorry," she cried, big tears on her face.
"That's lousy," I shouted. My head was pounding. I was so furious. "It isn't fair. I'm not going to stand for it. They don't have any right."
But they did, of course. They had all the right in the world. They had bought us and paid for us, and so they owned us. I knew that. I just didn't want to accept it, even by admitting what I knew was so. The notion of screwing Carolyn flipped polarity. It wasn't what I desperately wanted. It was what I would have died to avoid, as long as it meant letting them paw her with my hands, kiss her with my mouth, flood her with my juices. It was like the worst kind of rape, worse than anything I had ever done. Both of us raped at once. And then I felt that burning tingle in my forehead as they took over. I couldn't even scream. I just had to sit there inside my own head, no longer owning a muscle, while those freaks who owned me did to Carolyn with my body all manner of things, and I could not even cry. After concluding the planned series of experimental procedures, which were duly recorded, the purchased person known as Carolyn Scherner was no longer salvageable. Appropriate entries were made. The probation and out-service department of the Meadville Women's Reformatory was notified that she had ceased to be alive. A purchasing requisition was initiated for a replacement, and her account was terminated. The purchased person, known as Wayne Golden, was assigned to usual duties, at which he functioned normally while under control. It was discovered that when control was withdrawn, he became destructive, both to others and to himself. The conjecture has been advanced that that sexual behavior which had been established as his norm, the destruction of the sexual partner, may not have been appropriate in the conditions obtaining at the time of the experimental procedures. Further experiments will be made with differing procedures and other partners in the near future. Meanwhile, Wayne Golden continues to function at normal efficiency, provided control is not withdrawn at any time, and apparently will do so indefinitely.
That was We Purchased People by Frederick Pohl, soon to be a major motion picture, presented here with Fred's gracious permission. And that's a full lid. Please come back on the first Friday of next month for Spider on the Web number 54, when I will bring you some more superb short work by another science fiction writer who is as talented, accomplished, and important to the field as Fred Pohl himself. I speak of my friend John Varley. Thank you all most kindly for your subscriptions, donations, and good thoughts generally. And now to play us out, here once again are God and Bill and Matthew Campbell with their hit single, Human Phospholipase A211A, Residues 21 through 144.
As always, Spider on the Web 53 is brought to you under Creative Commons license, no derivatives, non-commercial. To subscribe or donate to Spider on the Web, visit spiderrobinson.com/podcast.html. Polite comments and suggestions are welcomed at spiderweb@shaw.ca.